I'm not telling you what I believe. I'm telling you what is taught in the mysteries. I'm telling you what our enemies believe. Make no mistake about it, they are our mortal enemies. They want to see us wiped off the face of the earth.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. All along the Watchtower, Bristol's city walls, briefing three tonight on the death of democracy here in Britain. Yes, a new series on authoritarian Britain is looking at the building blocks of a police state being assembled around us, briefing three tonight, with 30 Tory MPs facing charges of election fraud from May 2015. Did the Conservative Party steal last year's general election? And why, 18 months down the line, there's still been no prosecutions? Is this the ultimate in the establishment, sweeping their own misdemeanours under the carpet while throwing our democracy in the bin? Meanwhile, blithely passing laws to protect a bevy of Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell like criminals within the government and secret services. And what happens now to Cuba with the death last weekend of Cuba's king, Fidel Castro, although he'd hate to be called that, of course? Can the country hold to the ideals of the revolution? And come to think of it, what's the difference between a monarchy and a dictatorship ruled by a dynasty? Aren't they really just two ways of saying the same thing? Jackie Cannon joins us to go through Cuba's history and also look at some prospects for the future. Our sister show Dialect is here on BCFM 93.2 every Tuesday. This week we go back to look at the Veterans for Peace conference, talk to one of the US Veterans for Peace there, who's also a musician. Also looking at the next generations of nuclear power with less chance of accidents and minimal nuclear waste. Can we ask, why are we spending tens of billions on redundant technology at Hinkley C? We start this week, as usual, looking around some of the world's hotspots. Martin Summers, we've seen, you know, as usual this week, quite a few little bits and pieces, but we've got a pretty horrific looking pick for Defence Secretary over in the United States, haven't we?
Yeah, Mad Dog Mattis, or whatever his name is. The Trump administration raised some hopes that with the appointment of Flynn as the National Security Advisor, that they were going to tone down the rhetoric vis-a-vis Russia and Syria. But the economic picks that Trump has chosen are very much part of the neoliberal right wing who just want to cut taxes on the wealthy. And the military people are, frankly, scary.
Yeah, this guy is called General James Mad Dog Mattis. I say this right. General James Mad Dog Mattis, as Defence Secretary, the BBC is saying. He's a former Marine who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. He is our best, Mr. Trump said, as he announced his pick speech in Ohio. He's an outspoken critic of the Obama administration's Middle East policy, particularly on Iran. He's referred to Iran as the single most enduring threat to stability and peace in the Middle East.
I would suggest that that is the United States of America itself, backed up very closely by Israel. So this is a classic case of projection. Iran hasn't invaded any other countries in the last 200 or 300 years. It was itself invaded in 1980 by Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis with the support of the West, who wanted to try and crush the Iranian
Revolution.
They
say, apparently, he's the closest thing to General Patton, the World War II commander that we've got.
Well, General Patton was a notorious lunatic in his own right. I mean, in many respects, people didn't really want to serve under Patton because he was, for example, the whole Battle of the Bulge was his fault because he insisted on he wanted his guys to get into Germany first. So troops were basically sent south to help him when they should have been backing up Operation Market Garden in the north, which was the main thrust. But in order to keep Patton happy, they basically spread themselves too thin. The Germans saw the gap, and then the counterattack, nearly defeating the whole Allied invasion.
Well, Patton also famously wanted to attack Russia at the end of the war, didn't he? He used the German troops to go with the American troops to invade Russia.
Yeah, he was basically, when you know, think of General Patton was a blowhard. And if this guy's modelled on Patton, well, yeah, get your tin hats on.
So, yeah, how do you think it's panning out, Trump's various people he's picking for his cabinet?
Well, I've never had any expectations of anything other than an extremely unpleasant-looking administration. That's what we're getting. The soft talk vis-à-vis Russia is welcome. And the attempt to try... I mean, Flynn, for example, was saying when he was head of the Defence Intelligence Agency that he was unhappy with the policy of supporting jihadis against the Syrian government, and that he was basically under the table helping the Syrians. But he's basically got anti-Muslim views. I mean, really anti-Muslim views, not just anti-Muslim extremist views, anti-Muslim views. And they've all lining up to say that they're not going to do a deal with Iran, they're going to cancel this nuclear deal, etc.
Is it as simple as the fact that the Russians can actually fight back, as they've proved in Syria, against American foreign policy, but the Iranians may be a bit weaker?
Well, exactly. I mean, what they're trying to do is they're moving back to a more rational policy on picking on people smaller than themselves. But they've got to remember that the Iranians have very good relations, both with the Russians and the Chinese, and all of this debate about who they're going to attack next is being carried out in public.
I mean, the real
and
opponents...
The Russians can hear what's being said as well as anybody else can.
The real opponents of the Iranians in the Middle East are actually the Israelis. So is this Israeli foreign policy working its way through?
Basically it is. It's not even driven. James Petras, who's an academic in the US, very knowledgeable about Latin America, Jackie may have come across him. I mean, he's very clear that the Israeli lobby in the US dominates the policy to an extent where it isn't really even the policy of the US ruling class. It's the policy of a section within that ruling class, which is tied to the state of Israel as a gendarme in the Middle East for their interests.
But Russia, it looks like they're not going to take them on militarily, particularly since we've seen the fall or the liberation of Aleppo this week. Most of the last parts of it held by the terrorist groups or the rebel groups, as they're called on the BBC. But it looks like there may be a targeting of Russian propaganda as HR 6393, Intelligence Authorization Act, fiscal year 2017, passed in the House of Representatives on the 30th November this week. This is a bill targeting Russian propaganda, so they may not be able to take the Russians on militarily.
We'll have to see how this plays out, because the Republicans are now in control both of Senate and of Congress, and the general consensus amongst the ruling class in the US is to be hostile to Russia. So Trump has been an outlier on this, and Flynn also an outlier. But, I mean, Flynn has written a book with Michael Ledeen, who's a notorious neocon, and they've still got these delusions of dominating the world. I mean, look at the way Trump's presented his critique of NATO. The problem with NATO is obsolete, because all these people don't pay enough into it, and we might just walk away. And this is laughable. I mean, NATO has forced the Western European countries into a confrontation with Russia to prevent them having a decent economic relationship with Russia, which would gradually squeeze out the Americans. So the idea that somehow we're not paying our way is absurd. I mean, we're doing all... I mean, we invaded Iraq and in Afghanistan to keep the Americans happy. That's obviously not enough for them.
Yes, General Mad Dog Mattis, we're going to be hearing quite a lot about him in future, Martin. He's retired, he's 66 years old, but he's retired as the Chief of US Central Command in spring 2013. Now, US CENTCOM, who are these people? We hardly ever hear about them.
The US have a command structure for the whole of the planet. So CENTCOM covers the Middle East, basically. and he was in charge of, and they've got AFRICOM. AFRICOM is quite fascinating because they set up AFRICOM and they were going to base it in some African country, and no African country wanted anything to do with it. They said, well, we don't want an AFRICOM. They said, well, you need an AFRICOM to protect you. So, they, you know, it's very much a protection racket that the US are involved in. You know, nasty accidents could happen if we didn't protect you. But we're fine. No, the nasty accidents can happen, and then nasty accidents do happen. So then you need the protection.
Well, CENTCOM, Central Command, is joint task force responsibilities for coordinating all American foreign policy and defence, founded in 1983, but it's based over in the US in Tampa, Florida. So this is where he comes from. Also, one of the things, apparently he said, I'll put a link up to it on our show page. I don't have time to go through them all now. Lots and lots of quotes which are really extremely anti the Iranians. He just seems to hate the country.
Yeah, wants
to see it wiped out.
They're sending a very clear signal to the Iranians that just because we're talking nice to the Russians, and it's not even clear they are talking nice to the Russians, they could be speaking out of both sides of their mouths anyway on that one. It's a dangerous time.
Is it a clear sort of divide and rule type thing? Like, we'll be nice to the Russians, but we don't think the Russians are that allied to the Iranians?
I think they want... They don't really... I mean, to be honest, Trump doesn't really understand the implications of all of this. He's a businessman. But he is now... He liked Flynn because Flynn was a bit of a maverick, but both Flynn and Dempsey, who we haven't mentioned, were pushed out because they weren't happy with the policy of supporting jihadis to overthrow Assad, and they thought that bit, you know, we've got to fight international Islamic terrorism. Now, in actual fact, what's been shown in the Syrian crisis over the last few years, that international Islamic terrorism is largely created by NATO intelligence services and the countries of the Gulf, like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, etc. And so, therefore, there's an element of make-believe in all of this. You know, it's just a bit silly.
Well, we're talking about Syria just there, and the beginning of the end of the IS occupation and rebel occupation of Aleppo. But at the same time, Turkey, at least according to Michael Snyder, has declared war on Syria. Does this mean World War III is about to erupt in the Middle East? Well, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has just announced the only reason Turkish military forces have entered northern Syria is to end the rule of the tyrant al-Assad by publicly proclaiming that Turkey intends to use military force to overthrow the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Erdogan has essentially declared war on Syria. Of course, this puts a member of NATO in direct military conflict with Russia.
Yeah, I mean, Erdogan's comment has been very much remarked upon. And also this week, Turkish troops were actually killed in a bombing raid by somebody. It wasn't the Russians, because the Russians said we didn't do it, but it's quite likely it was the Syrians.
You trust them, do you?
No, I think the Russians, if they'd done it, would have said that they'd done it. I think it was the Syrian Air Force that attacked them. And, of course, they shouldn't be there. They've got no basis in international law to be on the other side of that border. See, and if they say, well, we can set up a safe zone in Syria, well, the Syrians might say, well, we're going to support the PKK rebels in Turkey to set up an independent state in Kurdistan. And we can all set up different groups in different countries to fight for independence for little bits of those countries. If we're going to go down that road, then Turkey had better watch
but
out.
But it's funny. Not,
because their borders aren't
there's been hardly,
set in stone either.
Hardly any comment about that this week, even though this is the first time that the Turkish president has said that basically that they want to have regime change and they're there to overthrow Assad. And
well, I mean, the Syrians will have been aware of that from the get-go. But one of the other things Trump is saying is that he wants to name the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organisation. Well, that is, in fact, the main support of the Erdogan regime in Turkey, is the Muslim Brotherhood. So he's on a collision course with them. And, of course, most people in Turkey are pretty much aware that the attempted coup against Erdogan was carried out by the Americans, or elements within the Turkish armed forces.
Also, alongside this, we hear from Keep Talking Greece in politics, so keeping a very close eye on the EU. The Greeks are. They've had probably a pretty harsh time from the EU over the last few years, and particularly because they're in the Eurozone. The European Commission is planning to propose the creation of a fund for military procurement and research, part of a wider plans for the EU Defence Union. The proposal, which came out Wednesday, seen by the Reuters, says member states should pool money money in a European Defence Fund could be used to purchase items such as helicopters, warships and drones. Now, this is a $5 billion fund. I mean, this is great for the defence industry.
Yeah, I understand that the British position is to oppose this European initiative, and that's annoying other members of the ruling elite in the European Union, saying, well, you're leaving the European Union and you're telling us what we can and can't do. But I think this just shows the contradictions at the heart of all of this. I mean, it's actually...
They're trying to show a united front across Europe, surely.
A united front against who?
Well, if things kick off in the Middle East, like it looks like they may well do.
Well, in that case...
Even more than they already have.
We know that MIT in Turkey, the intelligence services there, have been supporting ISIS all the way. That's certainly the view of the HDP, the Kurdish majority party in the parliament and so on. So are we going to go to war with Turkey, our NATO ally? The people we arm and train, and whose chaps are trained at Sandhurst, like the Saudis. The Saudis, all 19 hijackers on 9/11, supposedly, were from Saudi Arabia. Why didn't we go to war with Saudi Arabia, the people that keeps filtering in overtime?
Well, Aleppo and the end of the occupation, or beginning of the end of it anyway, came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week. The SNP, Angus Robertson, raising it.
Mr. Angus Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A very happy St. Andrew's Day to everybody celebrating in Scotland and around the world. Mr. Speaker, there is... Mr. Speaker, there is literally nothing to celebrate about the humanitarian catastrophe befalling the people of Syria at this time. The situation in the besieged city of Aleppo is described as being so bad that it could be one of the biggest massacres of civilian population since World War II. What can the UK and the international community do to end the suffering of the people of Syria?
Prime Minister.
The Right Honourable Gentleman is right to draw attention to the appalling situation that is taking place in Syria, and particularly the indiscriminate attacks that we see on civilians in Aleppo. The United Kingdom has been working with France to bring forward an emergency discussion on this issue at the UN Security Council. That will take place later today. We want to see a cessation of hostilities. We want to see an opportunity for aid, humanitarian aid, to have access to Aleppo, and we will be pressing for that at the Security Council.
Well, I mean, this makes me despair when I hear the SNP coming out with this sort of thing. When they talk about the siege of Aleppo, it's one part of Aleppo. The vast majority of the citizens of Aleppo are now basically relatively safe under the control of the Syrian government, even though the rebels continue to shell civilian areas indiscriminately from their hideouts in the bits where they control. 80,000 people have been liberated this week by the Syrian army. They welcome them with open arms and said they were being held by force by the rebels. These rebels are in fact armed and trained by NATO. So the fact that these people are so keen to support these rebels is fascinating to me, because the al-Nusra Front that they are supporting is al-Qaeda, who we supposedly spent 15 years storming through various countries of the world to defeat, and we are now allied with them. Why? What is going on there? I'm not at all surprised, because al-Qaeda was, of course, created by the Western intelligence services in order to fight the Russians in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And then they claim that they lost control of the network, but I don't think they ever did. And nobody in Turkey, for example, whatever side of the political spectrum they're on, believes anything else.
Well, talking about al-Qaeda, we don't hear that much about 9/11 and al-Qaeda, since we're now apparently working with them over in Syria. But this week's some fascinating news out about the September the 11th attacks, which has not got any kind of coverage over here at all, from two different sources, in fact. One is from Alaska University, and this is what really sent it down. A shock report, this is in last Saturday's Express, reveals 9/11 tower did not collapse because of fire. A shock new report into the collapse of World Trade Center Tower 7 fuels the fires of conspiracy, as it suggests multiple blazes caused its downfall. The building, which was situated next to New York's Twin Towers, crumbled after the planes hit the towers. Conspiracy theorists have long suggested controlled explosions were carried out in the building, but the official version of events says flaming debris from the burning Twin Towers flew into the 47th floor skyscraper and therefore bringing it down. This is Dr. J. Leroy Halsey from Alaska University revealed their team's boss's findings at the Justice in Focus symposium in New York. He said, it's our preliminary conclusions based on our work to date that fire did not produce the failure of this building.
Well, if anybody's interested in this topic, they should just Google or any other search engine WTC7 and watch it come down into its own footprint at free fall speed. Interestingly enough, Donald Trump in 2001, who actually builds skyscrapers in New York, is on the record, and you can look that up as well, saying, "I don't believe that fire brought down these buildings." Nor do architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, who visited Bristol some years ago now, and we had a big meeting for them in Colston Hall. I think all of the evidence suggests that these buildings were brought down by bombs inside the buildings. That's certainly what General Ivashov, who was commander of the Russian armed forces on the day, has said. It's certainly what General Gul, who was the commander of the Pakistani ISI, has said. It's what various scientists have basically said, who have looked into this, and we're talking about architects and engineers here, and it's now being picked up by the Daily Express, and of course was picked up by Donald Trump in 2001.
Also,
what's he going to do?
Also this week, a former NIST employee speaks out. He's a whistleblower, saying that Tower 7 investigation was bogus, that the government denied evidence. This is out just this week. A former employee of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, in the US, has stepped forward and criticised the government agency for ignoring scientific errors found in its report on the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7. During the September 11th attacks, and Peter Ketchum is his name, who spent almost 15 years working at NIST, described how flawed investigation methods were significantly different from normal standards used by NIST in a letter to the editor of the respected Europhysics News magazine. Ketchum's letter was published in the November 2016 edition and comes just months after the magazine's August 2016 report examining the Building 7 collapse in detail, which has been downloaded over 350,000 times, according to their website. Peter Ketchum was a contributor to numerous scientific papers during his 14 years as part of the High Performance Systems and Services Division, and later the Mathematical and Computational Sciences Division at NIST.
It's taken quite a long time for scientists to come forward and critique what was pretty obvious to some of us on day one, that this was not what it seemed. And as I mentioned earlier, Donald Trump, as an entrepreneur that builds skyscrapers, was very suspicious immediately. He's on the record. People can check this up, and they're just checking on by going online. We'll put a link.
We'll put a link on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to that.
And I think, of course, you know, Alex Jones, who's been a big supporter of Donald Trump, and Donald Trump even phoned him to thank him for his support after he won the election, if he did. He's been for many years banging on about the fact that 9/11 was some kind of inside job. This isn't fringe stuff anymore. President of the United States has actually said it, or for, you know, president elect. It's about. I say to Donald, what are you going to do about it?
BCFM. Well, I'm joined in the studio now by Jackie Cannon. Hi, Jackie, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you. Hello.
Now, you're here to talk about Fidel Castro, bless him, who passed away just after this show finished, actually, last week. Just give us a bit of an outline of your interest in Cuba and your experience there.
Okay, thanks, Tony. So I have been going back and forth to Cuba for the last 6 years. My husband's Cuban. I've worked over there. I was translating for the newspaper. I have friends and family over there, and have been very curious about the fact that the discourse in this country and in the West tends to be rather negative towards someone who's viewed very differently in Cuba itself.
Well, for example, Donald Trump came out straight away, didn't he? Pretty much called him a tyrant.
Well, brutal dictator, I think he used. Yeah. And that, you know, when maybe some people are mourning, is kind of offensive to quite a lot of people. But I think it's really important to look at and I have been looking a lot at it, is the difference between how the Western media, if you like, the mainstream media, has been presenting Fidel Castro and the Cuban political structure and scene, as in contrast to how in Cuba itself it's presented and experienced. And one of the things that I think is very important that needs to be highlighted is, if we look, comments about Fidel being a brutal dictator are completely founded on the US relationship with Cuba, primarily of the 1950s onwards, 1959, particularly when the triumph of the Cuban Revolution. And actually to understand who Fidel Castro was and what he represents and what the revolution represents, you really have to go back 100 years before that. And the Cubans are educated. They're an educated people. That was one of the triumphs of the revolution itself. And that Fidel Castro, largely based on the philosophy of José Martí from the 19th century, was very committed to people being free via education. Right? So they were educated. They know their history. And who, you know, you haven't mentioned it, but I'm going to mention it. I published a book last year, actually this year, Cuba, One Moment in Time, which came out of the re-establishment of diplomatic relationships between Cuba and the US that was announced on the 17th of December 2014. And what stimulated me for writing that book was really to look at who am I to judge and what am I judging, because I was obviously I was in Cuba at the time. I was there for 3 months, and the announcement of the reestablishment of diplomatic relations was actually a week after I arrived, so I had plenty of time to look at how Cubans were responding to that and how the press in the mainstream media that I was accessing via the internet and also people who were visiting Cuba were actually talking about it. And I just saw that there was a huge mismatch, if you like. And I became, you know, obviously I'd been interested anyway in the country, but I started to look at not just the history of the country and not just the relationship between the US and Cuba, but also the eyes through which I was viewing it. And I think, you know, we have to remember that in Cuba there was it was the 15th century, 1492, that Columbus sailed the oceans blue. And actually, you know, the way we talk about it, he discovered Cuba, of course, and colonized for the Spanish crown. Well, of course, the difficulty with that is the people who were living on the island, they knew Cuba was there, or they didn't, whatever they called it, but they were the country was colonized and it became part of the Spanish Empire. And largely Cuban history can be largely divided into three major strands, if you like, major periods. The first one being the colonial period, 1492 to 1898, when it being amongst the last of the Spanish colonies to fall and gain independence. The neo-colonial period, as it's known, 1898 to 1959, and then the revolutionary period. Now, we can't look at the revolutionary period without having some understanding of the neo-colonial period and the intervention and influence of the US during that time and the impact on the Cuban people. And even the colonial, you know, very clearly the colonial period, because the Cuban fight for independence or struggle for independence had actually started way back. 1868 was the start of the 10-year war. So it was 1868 to 1878, and there was a call for armed struggle against the Spanish crown. And that was actually constituted by people who were born on the island who weren't given the right to be Spanish because they weren't born in Spain, And also the slaves. By that stage, slavery was becoming less accepted. So then from 1879, 1880, there was, it was kind of quiet. There was a shorter war. But then from 1895 to 1898, there was the Cuban War of Independence. That is sometimes called the Great War. It's sometimes called the Necessary War. And pretty much the Cubans had already won it. And on the 15th of February 1898, when Cuba was pretty much already... the people had already been struggling, and the Spanish crown was about to be completely defeated. On the 15th of February 1898, the USS Maine was blown up in Havana Harbour. And what was important about that was that it was a US ship, it was there to protect American interests in Cuba, which were under threat because they were linked to the Spanish crown, of course, and the Spanish crown was about to be defeated. So the USS Maine was exploded in Havana Harbour. There's been much speculation that about how that happened, who caused it.
Well, let me just bring Martin in. This is one of those things that you know a bit about, Martin.
Well, the USS Maine, that's related to what we were talking about 9/11. In other words, it was a casus belli for the US intervention in that war, and there's still very much, it's very murky. It was either an accident, it was certainly nothing to do with the Spanish, or it had been deliberately blown up, which of course is, you know, quite credible if you think about the kind of things that have happened since then.
I think that's really important because, you know, when I say there's been a lot of speculation, pretty much most of the people I've spoken to in Cuba believe that it was the US, the United States, opportunity provoked by themselves to intervene in the war. And of course, then what they did, that was the start of the the Spanish-American War. And the US came in as, oh yes, we're going to support independence, we're going to strengthen independence for Cuba. But in fact, one of the earliest things they did was they said, right, we're going to take responsibility for foreign policy and protection of the island, under which that was when they secured the Guantanamo naval base. It was their outpost for protecting the island, allegedly. But of course, what happened then was the people who'd been engaged for 40 odd years in an independence struggle were not willing to go from subjugation to one colonial power and submit themselves to another. And that, of course, is something that's not really spoken about. So that was already by 1901, the very beginning of the 20th century, it was clear that the US intervention was for US interests. So the European colonies had collapsed, Spain, the different colonies that all had some representation in the Caribbean, and the independence movement in Cuba said, no, we're not going to submit to just one more imperialist power. And of course, so then we move into the neo-colonial period, and there was a bit of to-in and fro-in, if you like, between more revolutionary, less revolutionary. And it became... Cuba became the playground of the celebrities, the moneyed classes in the US. And of course, don't forget that in the 1930s, particularly, it was the time of prohibition in the US. So Cuba became the playground. And there was very clear interest from some parties in the United States to annex Cuba. Cuba, the people of Cuba, you know, still wounded from an independence war and victorious, were not actually willing to be annexed and abused, if you like, or misused or appropriated. And in fact, so you know, that period became, well, it moved forward. By the end of the 1940s, there was a lot of corruption. There was drugs, there was prostitution, there was gambling, and of course all those things that had been transported to Cuba, which hadn't, that weren't permitted in the US. And Fulgencio Batista, he actually became the president of Cuba. And he was quite revolutionary at first, but then he was in power for 4 years and then went back to the United States. And that was, he was in power from 1940 to 1944. And then he was exiled between 44 and 52, and he was living in Florida. So he wanted to come back and run for president in Cuba in 1952. And he saw he wasn't actually going to win. So he had won by elections in 1940, but he saw in 1952 he wasn't going to win. And so that's when he staged the coup. So there was it was a likely defeat at the elections, and in order not to suffer the defeat, he staged a military coup. Now, the financial, the military, and the logistical power was coming with support from the United States. And he revoked the 1940 Constitution. So he came to power, he revoked the 1940s Constitution. And in the he started to revoke political liberties. There was an increasing presence of drugs, gambling, prostitution, of course. Although Batista was saying, well, no, we've got to protect the country from this, what he was doing was taking money from largely the mafia. So a lot of the hotels and the tourist areas in Cuba were built with mafia money. And it was there was obviously, throughout the time, there'd been a revolutionary contingent who were actually not wanting to be subjected to the US, as I said before. And the CIA was supporting, the US was supporting Batista with the BRAC. So it was the anti-communist military force. It was a very strong, very brutal body, the Bureau for Repression of Communist Activities. And of course they were allowed to do anything, or they permitted themselves to do anything. An increasing nervousness, if you like, about, well, we've got to delete these communist activities. We're talking Cold War period, and of course what's happened now is the Cold War is still the discourse with which Cuba is normally referred these days. But it's okay, so the US, they didn't want communist activities, but the revolution that Fidel Castro represented, if you like, he didn't really have a clear political ideology. He certainly never said he was communist.
Okay, well, what about the revolution 1958 and then the there, well, basically, it was a Cuban Missile Crisis after that, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, I think before the Cuban Missile Crisis, what we need to know, and it's interesting, today is the 2nd of December, which is actually the 60th anniversary of the landing of the Granma yacht with Fidel Castro and his 80-odd revolutionaries. So Fidel Castro, and there'd been, during, in 1953, there'd been the assault on the Moncada barracks. Fidel Castro actually defended himself and famously said, "History will absolve me." And he was still sent to prison for 15 years. But 3 years later, 1956, he was liberated along with the other revolutionaries who'd been involved in that Moncada barracks, the ones that weren't killed anyway. And in 1956, there were going to be elections, and reportedly, Batista held an amnesty, if you like, let those revolutionaries out of prison, because there was a lot of support for them. So he hoped to win the votes of the people who were favourable towards the revolutionaries. Anyway, it was at that stage that Fidel Castro went to Mexico. That's where he met Che Guevara, and they organised themselves to actually come back and come back to Cuba on the Granma yacht, which landed on the 2nd of December in 1956. And then there was a 3 year there was a period of, well, 2 years of revolutionary struggle through the rural areas, very, very largely, which gathered momentum, and that's how, by January 1959, the revolutionary forces were able to move into Havana, and Batista saw that, you know, his time was up. It had already been forecast a bit, but he saw that, you know, he couldn't say, well, what had happened during all his time? He'd been taking money from the mafia. The largest area of production for Cuba was sugar. And it was a very single product market, if you like, production, but the US used to buy pretty much all of Cuba's sugar. And the precursor to the Cuban Missile Crisis was that after the revolutionary forces triumphed, the US said, right, okay, we've got to bring these down. We've got to bring these down, and we'll stop all sugar imports.
But it's amazing that they let them get away with it in the first place. In a way, Martin, you know, the way that this whole Syria rebels thing has been spun over the last few years is almost trying to make them look like kind of Fidel Castro and his mates in Cuba are trying to run a popular revolution, isn't it?
What happened after the triumph of the Cuban Revolution was that the Americans then got very paranoid about guerrilla warfare. So they developed what they called counterinsurgency doctrines to defeat it, and which ultimately, of course, led to Che Guevara dying in Bolivia. He was actually captured by ex-Nazis working with the CIA, because, of course, they used ex-Nazis from Argentina, which was Che Guevara's home country, as part of what they were doing. So you had Klaus Barbie operating in Bolivia at that time. And the Cubans then became a central focus for this idea of what Régis Debray called the FOCO theory, that a small group of revolutionaries could sort of insert themselves into a situation, and by fighting they would empower the masses, and then they would be able to take power. And I think that was actually trying to extrapolate from the Cuban Revolution too far. You know, what worked once, because the Americans were taken by surprise, is not necessarily going to work again and again. And Guevara in particular pushed that line, whereas Fidel tended to be more cautious about this sort of thing.
So, Jackie, can we quickly look at the missile crisis and then see, you know, where you think Cuba's headed now?
Well, what Fidel and I think Che Guevara said in the early 60s, in the very early 60s, is that, you know, we weren't communists, but of course, having had their sugar supply or the imports of their main production deleted, the country was looking at extreme poverty. And some, you know, in that moment of the Cold War, the Soviet bloc was willing to support Cuba, and they started buying sugar and they started providing other goods. Now, what happened then was of course it was in return for something, and one of those, the Cuban Missile Crisis was as a result of that. You know, yes, they were putting missiles. It was a defensive measure. But actually, much of this has been documented, but from every different perspective.
Well, I know some of the American generals were saying to President Kennedy at the time, well, hey, guys, we've got to get in there fast before they get any of these, like, tactical nuclear weapons in, things like that in. Whereas, actually, all the time, they already had some tactical nuclear weapons in. So the American generals were saying to Kennedy, hey, quick, we've got to get in there fast. And although they quietly knew, they were tricking the president, saying, well, you know, which could itself have sparked a nuclear war if the Cuban forces and the Russians supporting them had used tactical nuclear weapons against an American invasion force. This is before these intercontinental ballistic missiles even arrived. But look, this was an amazing time, you know, late 1962. I can remember friends of the family saying, oh, well, the supermarkets emptied right across Britain, basically. There was no food. You couldn't buy a can of anything because people thought there was going to be a nuclear war. But what about now, Jackie? Let's look a little bit more positively at the future. Do you think that the revolution there and the conditions, the good health conditions, education conditions, etc., are safe?
My personal view, and based on what, you know, conversations with Cubans and watching what they're writing on Facebook and in the press this week, is absolutely they're safe. The Cuban people are, you know, I've heard it said, and you might have noticed on various posts this week on Facebook, you know, when after the bombings in Paris, we had people putting the French flag up on their Facebook images, you know, profile photos. What I've seen this week quite a bit of, and it's not all of them, of course, is Yo soy Fidel. So I am Fidel. And what they're actually, you know, what I've heard said in the past is that part of the reason the Americans have never, you know, I mean, you mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis, but we didn't actually mention the Bay of Pigs in 1961, and that's still in the memory of Cubans. And the one of the aspects that I've heard people say is that the reason the Americans haven't actually invaded is that there is a defense force in Cuba of 11 million people. Now, I've heard lots of people saying, oh, yeah, what about the millions or the hundreds of thousands who've escaped or who've, you know, fled? And, well, people move. I mean, I do actually make that comment in my book, because my own mother was Irish. And she, you know, you could say, well, she fled to England because of the poverty in the west of Ireland, you know.
Well, Donald Trump certainly not been making particularly good noises about it. He says if Cuba is unwilling to make a better deal for the Cuban people, the Cuban and American people and the U.S. as a whole, I will terminate the deal. So he's immediately threatening to, you know, go back to the old ways.
No, it's very interesting, because obviously in March this year, President Obama was in Cuba. What was really clear from what he was saying was, we want to help the Cuban people. Our efforts to bring down the government haven't worked. We're just going to try a different strategy. So they didn't actually say, we're not going to keep persecuting them and interfering with the government of a sovereign republic, which happens to be our neighbour. They weren't saying that. And what they what Trump is saying and what everyone's saying, there's still the blockade is still in force. So even after the reestablishment of the diplomatic relations, the US government continues to to pay huge sums of money to the Center for Democratic Reform, I think it's called. So I might have that name wrong. But they continue to penalize companies in third countries that do business with Cuba. They have not, you know, when they talk about, oh, we want to make life better for the Cubans, well, one way of doing that would be lifting the blockade. But they won't do that because they actually are still, their major intention is still to bring down the government. And I'd like to say a couple of things about the future, what the future holds. Well, the Cuban people are the ones who get very little exposure, the ones in Cuba, because no one's able to convey that. And they, in the majority, are willing to support the current administration, current government, to be able to bring about the ongoing reforms that have been in place anyway, and continue as a sovereign republic, independent.
Martin, do you think that with the Trump administration, we're going to see a return to the old ways, demonising, really, of Cuba?
Well, if they do, then they'll probably force a reaction from the Cuban population. I mean, the blockade hasn't been lifted anyway, so the carrot's not very big. So that's not going to change much on the ground in Cuba. I think more dangerous, as we're seeing over the rest of Latin America, is the collapse of left regimes because of the economic crisis. The left regimes in Brazil and Venezuela, Argentina and so on. And we talk about Castro the dictator, but of course all of those countries were under military dictatorships backed up 100% by the Americans, in which in Argentina, for example, 30,000 people died horrible deaths under torture, and there's no repentance from that from the United States.
Well, good luck to Cuba in the future with this kind of attitude from the US. Basically, if you don't do as you're told, then we're going to put you under sanctions and possibly invade you even. So final word, Jackie.
Yeah, so one thing that the Cubans are still very kind of upset about is the fact that the blockade hasn't been lifted, but nor has the Cuban Adjustment Act. And that actually gives Cubans who claim to be fleeing the island, it gives them a load of good conditions in America, and it's to cause subversion. So if the US wants stable relations, that's one thing they could start with.
Okay.
And get rid of.
Jackie Cannon, author of Cuba, One Moment in Time, Exploring Political Defrost and Daily Reality in Havana, just out this year. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Final item tonight, Martin. Pretty quick, but 30 Tory MPs facing charges of election fraud from way back in May 2015. This story just seems to... We've had attacks on the SNP by the Electoral Commission or prosecutions or on UKIP and on Labour, but still not the Conservatives, even though if there are reruns in these 30 constituencies, the Conservatives might well lose their majority.
Well, they lost one of their majority yesterday in Richmond when the Liberals defeated them in the by-election there. And I think that this regime is not going to last the distance. I don't think they're going to go for an early election. They don't know what to do. But they will probably be chipped away at, and we will definitely get them before 2020.
Anyway, one thing very few people realise is that the story of the Tory election fraud, these 30 MPs that possibly should face by-elections, certainly there's very strong evidence in each of those constituencies that there there was fraud when doing election returns and there was overspending. That story actually started here in Bristol, and it was sent into a little online magazine called The Canary. So let's hear from Kerry-Ann Mendoza, who's the editor of The Canary, about how that story first started. I recorded her a couple of weeks ago.
The majority of our original journalism this year has been reader-generated stories. We get emails, we get text messages, we get messages on the Facebook page saying, this is happening. This is happening. In fact, we were the first UK media outlet to get hold of whistleblowers that were tied to the election expenses fraud scandal. They actually came to us. They were Canary readers. And they emailed us and said, we'd actually really like to talk to you. We think something very, very wrong took place over this period of time. And we were able to work with them, have their stories, publish our own stories. But we actually gave the story to Channel 4 News, because Channel 4 News were in a position that they could provide legal cover for the whistleblowers, and we weren't. So we were actually willing to give up a portion of the sort of the praise, the accolade associated with that exclusive, to make sure that fundamentally those whistleblowers were protected. So yeah, if you've got stories and you know you're sitting here now and there's something happening in your community, email Novara, email us, email the cable, because we'll be only too happy to get involved and cover it.
Kerry-Ann Mendoza there, editor of The Canary magazine. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up, Arabian Nights. Thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Also, Conservative Group and Bristol City Council leader Mark Weston. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday at noon. All sorts of interesting stuff on there next week. Also, I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. This show page is thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us for the politics show the same time next week. God bless. Don't let the banksters get you down.
National news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.